Radio Boston, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. James Whitey Bulger was back in Boston federal court today, 3 months after a jury convicted him of taking part in 11 murders while running a massive criminal enterprise in the city for decades.
This time, he appeared for day one of his sentencing hearing in an orange prison jumpsuit issued by the Plymouth County Correctional Facility. The family members of his victims were given the opportunity to address him, and they did not hold back. Coward, rat, Satan. Those were some of the names they called him. WBUR's Asma Khalid was at the hearing and joins us in the studio. And Asma, you were there today. What would you describe as the sense of emotion in the courtroom?
Well, it was highly emotional from the standpoint of all of the relatives of the Bulger victims that were there. Bulger himself was sort of stone-faced throughout. He showed absolutely no emotion. But when it comes to the victims and the victims' families, you heard a lot of different anger that was directed toward Bulger. As you said, those names, domestic terrorist, other names were thrown out.
Right, a lot of hate, a lot of vitriol. What was some of the most powerful testimony today by the family members of the victims?
Well, there was definitely a lot of name-calling. Steve Davis, who's the brother of Deborah Davis, and you might recall the jury actually said in that particular murder there was no finding. Nonetheless, he was allowed to speak at the sentencing hearing, and he said that he, you know, wishes that he could strangle Bulger, that he hopes he dies the same way his sister died, gasping for air. I mean, there was sort of that very vivid sort of vitriol that was spewed towards Bulger. But the other sort of emotional side of this was the anger that was directed toward the FBI and the Department of Justice. And that's something we heard from David Wheeler, who's the son of Roger Wheeler.
The FBI has protected him. They have supervised him. Without the FBI, my father would be alive today. My father trusted the FBI. That's why he got into that business, why he bought it. You know, he told me over and over again, the FBI keeps it clean. And it was just a setup.
So that there was David Wheeler. And as you can hear, I mean, that was a sentiment that was actually relatively prevalent among different relatives of the victims that spoke today.
And certainly gets us back to sort of that theme in the trial that it was the FBI on trial as much as Whitey Bulger himself.
Certainly.
So were there any victim family members today who did not seem angry, who took a different approach?
There was one. And I think that her statement was so powerful because it was the alternative to everything that we heard. Her name is Teresa Bond. She's the daughter of Arthur Bucky Barrett. And she began by asking Bulger. She said, "Mr. Bulger, will you look at me?" And that was important because throughout everybody else's statements, Bulger had been looking down. It was unclear if he was taking notes or looking down at some notes, but he did glance up when she asked him to. And then she went on to say that, you know, Bulger, Mr. Bulger, you're going to not only face the court here, but eventually you're going to face the court of God, the highest court. She seemed to be a very spiritual woman and also said at the end that she does forgive him. She feels that he does have remorse. She hopes that he does have remorse.
Now, Bulger said nothing today other than no when asked if he had anything to say. Was there a sense of surprise that he didn't speak on this final opportunity to speak publicly?
I think that there was. And I know that a lot of the relatives of these victims had hoped that he would speak. I think some people were curious as to what he would say. One person in particular who spoke to the media afterwards was Sean McGonigal. He's the son of Paul McGonigal. And we can take a listen to him.
I was surprised he didn't speak, you know, with his ego that he did not want to speak to any of the families where they addressed him. He never looked me in the eye. He never looked a lot of the other families in the eyes. So it's good to see him where he is, and he belongs where he is. And, you know, he'll be in that jail cell for a long time, we hope.
So that was a sentiment, though, that was relatively common. And the idea that Bulger didn't speak when he had the opportunity to, I think some people were disappointed. And you heard Sean McGonigal there say, you know, he didn't even look me in the eye. And that was something that I know folks were frustrated with. There was a little bit of a shouting between, you know, one person actually yelled a bunch of profanity at him, and Bulger did eventually glance up after being yelled at. But afterwards, his attorney, J.W. Carney, said that the reason Bulger didn't speak was because, you know, throughout this trial, Bulger has insisted that it was a sham. And let's hear what he had to say.
He did not want to validate the trial by participating directly or indirectly through us in the sentencing process.
Now, Asma, Bulger is expected to be sentenced tomorrow morning. Would you remind us what kind of sentence the prosecution is asking for?
Well, the prosecution has asked for 2 life terms of imprisonment plus 5 years. Bulger is already into his 80s, so regardless.
Life sentence, even a non-life sentence is a life sentence.
Exactly. And what's interesting is throughout this entire process, ever since Bulger has been convicted, the defense has sort of silently stood by. They have not offered any input. And in fact, they say that's why Bulger himself didn't speak, is because Bulger has insisted, and they are sort of acquiescing to the demands of their client, that he believes this was a sham trial. And so they have not offered any input into the type of sentence they feel would be fair.
That's WBUR's Asma Khalid. She was in federal court today for day one of Whitey Bulger's sentencing hearing. He is scheduled to be sentenced tomorrow morning. Asma, thank you.
Thank you.
Our goal is not the victory of might, but the vindication of right. Not peace at the expense of freedom, but both peace and freedom.
Our series, November 1963, is looking back at some of the major moments of John F. Kennedy's presidency to mark the 50th anniversary of his assassination.
Today, the high watermark of the Cold War, a 12-day period in October 1962 when the world seemed poised on the brink of nuclear war. WBUR's Kelly Horan takes us inside the Kennedy White House at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
On October 16th, President Kennedy tells his brother Robert, the Attorney General, that there is great trouble. That trouble is the discovery of Soviet missile sites in Cuba. A CIA agent briefs the president.
There's a medium-range ballistic missile launch site and 2 new military encampments in west central Cuba.
How far advanced is this?
Sir, we've never seen this kind of an installation before.
Even in the Soviet Union?
No, sir.
Kennedy's Joint Chiefs of Staff urges a nuclear strike on the Soviet installations. Air Force General Curtis LeMay tells the president, "We don't have any choice except direct military action." Privately, Kennedy says that the worst advice always comes from those who feared that to be sensible made them seem soft and unheroic. What Kennedy fears is igniting a nuclear war. He tells an aide, "I keep thinking about the children whose lives would be wiped out."
Good evening, my fellow citizens.
On October 22nd, Americans turn on their radios and televisions to hear a somber president deliver a terrifying message.
On the island of Cuba, within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere.
Kennedy describes a clear and present danger and an explicit threat to peace, nuclear warheads that could strike anywhere along the eastern seaboard, including Washington, D.C. In this address, Kennedy walks a rhetorical tightrope between the language of diplomacy and the language of war.
We will not prematurely or unnecessarily risk the course of worldwide nuclear war, in which even the fruits of victory would be ashes in our mouth. But neither will we shrink from that risk at any time it must be faced.
Kennedy defies generals with decades more experience. Instead of a declaration of war, he announces a 7-point plan that includes a naval blockade. He also makes a direct appeal to the Soviet premier.
I call upon Chairman Khrushchev to halt and eliminate this clandestine, reckless, and provocative threat to world peace and to stable relations between our 2 nations. I call upon him further to abandon this course of world domination and to join in an historic effort to end the perilous arms race and to transform the history of man. He has an opportunity now to move the world back from the abyss of destruction.
In the days that follow, Khrushchev backs down. He agrees to remove the warheads as long as the U.S. does not invade Cuba. Kennedy tells Harry Truman about this development in a telephone call on October 28th.
Hello?
Hello, this is Harry Truman.
Hello, how are you, Mr. President?
Well, I'm all right, and I'm just pleased to death the way these things came out.
Well, we'll just stay at it, and just wanted to bring you up to date on it.
Stay with us. Still ahead, working families priced out of the greater Boston housing market. We'll hear about some new proposals to make housing in the greater Boston area more affordable. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.